Want a recipe for success? Step one, visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses. Step two, click on my link to browse OCD Training School's amazing course catalog. Step three, enroll. And step four, enjoy learning. With no added cost to you, you can support the OCD family community while grabbing some continuing education or learning how to bridge yourself to self-help strategies for OCD. Again, that's OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses. And use my special link to sign up today.
Hey there, fam. It's less than 2 weeks until Christmas. And 'tis the season for one holiday after another. So I'm covering a timely topic regarding when OCD and eating disorder are affecting you or your loved one this holiday season. Because both of these conditions face their own set of challenges when there are more social gatherings, programs, and family time. So let's dive in with our special guest expert, Jenna Stone, LMSW, because Jenna has tips, y'all. And hope is on the menu.
I'm Nicole Morris, licensed marriage and family therapist and mental health correspondent. And let me be the first to say, welcome to the family, the OCD family, that is. I am here to create a community of support for family members, spouses, partners, parents, adult children, as there may be adult words, and chosen family of OCD sufferers and their community. I've had over 22 years of experience in the mental health field, but please note that this information does not qualify or substitute as a diagnostic evaluation, therapy, or treatment, and it is presented on an as-is basis. Please follow up with a qualified mental health provider in your area regarding concerns for yourself or loved ones. Thank you for joining us today. Now, let's get started.
Okay, fam. Alrighty. So I was thinking about how smushed, again, all these holidays have felt and how hard that can be. I also have had the honor of sitting with clients and hearing how the condensed nature of this holiday season can be so triggering. So I reached out to my colleague and new friend, Jenna Stone, and said, Jenna, please help. Because not only does Jenna know their business when it comes to OCD, but she also has expertise in treating eating disorders. So we're going to cover a lot of ground in this episode, but I do want to make a brief trigger warning because when we're in the territory of chatting about eating disorders, we do have to mention that they can be deadly. Increased suicidality amongst lethal health problems can result from this disorder, and we know suicidality can show up in OCD as well. So we will be chatting about that. Please proceed with discretion. But fam, there's so much hope too. So let me go ahead and tell you a little bit more about Jenna, and as always, I will have everything I mentioned here linked over on this episode's blog at OCDFamilyPodcast.com. So if you want to learn more about Jenna or any of the resources we discussed, just feel free to check that out because it's free and available for you, fam. So Jenna Stone, LMSW, is a queer ADHD therapist specializing in supporting neurodivergent individuals with eating disorders, OCD, anxiety, and BFRBs through a social justice framework, drawing on both professional expertise and personal lived experience. They provide in-person and telehealth psychotherapy as well as neuroaffirming ADHD and autism evaluations at Zen Psychological Center in Maryland. Additionally, as a co-founder of the Mid-Atlantic Collective for Eating Disorders, Jenna is dedicated to promoting weight-inclusive and neuroaffirming care rooted in harm reduction. So with that, let's meet Jenna. Welcome back to the OCD Family Podcast, and today I'm actually stoked. I say this like all the time, but I am really stoked because we are having such an important conversation today. I have guest Jenna Stone, LMSW, here with me, and they were kind enough to come and shed light on this really tricky intersection of OCD and eating disorder. And you will hear me reference eating disorder as ED. But I think it's such an important topic because not only is it a high prevalence, and I'm sure we'll get into all of that, but during the holiday season, which here in the States, we just had Thanksgiving, we have Christmas and Hanukkah for those whom celebrate, we have New Year's coming up where we always have these different resolutions and people are getting their gym memberships and whatnot. And you can imagine if we zoom out and look at the comorbidity of OCD and ED, this is a very complicated and very tricky time of year. So with all of that, Jenna, welcome to the OCD Family Podcast. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So, first off, we're going to cover a lot of different topics today, but I am curious, to the extent that you're comfortable, if you can share, how did you get into treating OCD in the first place, and if you would like in ED as well?
So I actually got in the field to treat eating disorders, and then I made that leap into OCD. In graduate school, I got trained in exposure response prevention, which we use a lot in eating disorders, but for OCD as well. And then during that time, I lived with OCD, so I was struggling with OCD. I've done ERP, and I got introduced to inference-based CBT and started doing it on myself and fell in love with OCD. I never thought I could work with OCD just because I was struggling so much in graduate school. But then I started to get real relief from my own OCD symptoms, and I felt more confident that I could treat OCD. And similarly with my eating disorder, I'm 10 years recovered from my own eating disorder. And that's got me really passionate about this whole intersection. I just kind of landed here, I guess, because I was that person that had both. And it was hard to find providers that understood both. So
congratulations on 10 years recovered, first of all. And second of all, thank you for following that excitement and sharing it with us as a worldwide community, because there's so much overlap. In fact, last time we really concentrated on eating disorder here on the show, even the title of the episode was about the incredible overlap of eating disorder and OCD. And so I'm thrilled to have you here and sharing your knowledge. And I will say this just for any other practitioners listening, it's not that you can't be very good and skilled at treating if you don't have lived experience. Absolutely, you can. But you can also provide a personal testament in the efficacy and the hope that comes in recovery. And so that's a really exciting message to give, especially at this time of year where both OCD and ED can get so triggered. And again, we're just talking about the presentations of this happen year round, but during the holidays, there are some extra challenges, different triggers that can come up. And so before we get into that, I just want to think about some statistics, and some of the statistics are a little bit older, but for ED, the International OCD Foundation, and I've shared this statistic before, back in 2004, was sharing a study, and I'm going to have all of this linked over on this episode's blog, so anybody interested in checking more information out about this, please jump on over to OCDFamilyPodcast.com, and you can see all the information we discussed today linked there. But 64% of people with eating disorder had at least one anxiety disorder. And of that 64%, which is a very high percentage, first of all, 41% of that 64% of anxiety disorder was OCD. Then there was some further research that same article cited in 2022. And again, all of this will be linked over on the blog, that with some more updated research, 62% of people with eating disorder also had a co-occurring anxiety disorder. 54% had a mood disorder, which can include anxiety, but can also include things like depression. There's multiple different mood disorders that could encapsulate. And 27%, so roughly a third, had either substance use disorder, PTSD, or both. And so there is a high overlap with eating disorder and OCD. And something that I have learned, and we were discussing before we even started recording, was that just in my work in this field and in the podcast, I've learned that a malnourished brain is also more likely to exhibit obsessive compulsive symptoms and presentations, even if OCD isn't a co-occurring disorder, because a malnourished brain is going to affect the way we process information, the brain fog. It's going to have a lot of different impacts there as well. And so today we're talking about how this can show up during the holidays. But I think what might be helpful, because I think there is a lot of misunderstanding. I don't know if that's even quite the right word. I don't know if it quite captures it, but misunderstanding about eating disorder, what it is. I think most people think of anorexia. They think of young, maybe white girls, but that's not accurate. Young white girls can get eating disorders, but everybody can get eating disorders. It can range. And so can we start with, first of all, when we're talking about eating disorder, what are we talking about, both in classic presentation as the DSM would define, and then also some of the trending, what may end up in a future iteration of the DSM, but trending eating difficulties that could also be a part of this conversation, like orthorexia, et cetera.
ARFID is in the the most recent DSM-5. So it's under the feeding and eating disorders. And so that's avoidant, food, restrictive intake disorder. And there's three subtypes of RFID, one of which is where people have completely no interest in food. I found that the most difficult to treat because they just are not interested in food. The other ones are more, I think, linked to OCD, the one subtype around like fear of vomiting, like adverse consequences associated with eating. So they get very malnourished because of fear of vomiting or, you know, having diarrhea or whatever it is, like they're going to get that fear. Really looks OCD like that presentation. The other one is the presentation that I actually see a lot in my practice is just aversion to food due to sensory preferences. And so either too spicy or not spicy enough, or they're too crispy or not, you know, like whatever someone, what their sensory profile looks like is going to really determine what kind of foods feel good to them. And then you can also have that type where you see this more in toddlers, but it does happen in adults with RFID, where they see something, let's say you order pizza from a restaurant and they put parsley on it. And like suddenly the brain's like, nope, not doing it for the screen. So that happens as well, which a lot of people are like, oh, they'll grow out of it. But in fact, we see adults that struggle with that as well. And so they feel socially limited with food. And I like to view RFID more as a disability than that is disorderly, but more so like from that like disability kind of view that it's disabling. And how do you navigate the world when the food we need to nourish our bodies, I look a lot different than what your body is telling you feels good to you or you can tolerate or can't tolerate. And how do you push through that threshold, if at all? Like, can you expand that window of tolerance? It's going to look very different for people depending, again, is this sensory, is this fear-based, or is there just no interest in eating? And I will just be completely vulnerable. I do not know how to treat that presentation where someone just does not have any interest in food. And I've seen it once when I worked in a residential center.
So they were on a feeding tube because
What
else do you do?
Right. So that's RFID, which is people like with RFID. So I thought I'd start there. The ones that aren't in the DSMs that I wanted to speak about is orthorexia, like you had just mentioned. So that's this like obsession with fitness culture and or healthy eating. Mm-hmm. You will kind of see it with clean eating. So people pursue eating clean and they're eating so clean that now they are malnourished. So it becomes a huge problem. And so in our eating disorder treatment world, we practice this idea of all foods fit, that all foods can fit into a healthy diet. So being able to tolerate things that, you might not get the biggest like bang for your buck in terms of like health, but like, hey, cake is really yummy and we deserve to have cake and ice cream and all those kind of really fun foods because that's important too. It's part of the joy of eating. And so that orthorexia where people are just so rigid, they become more rigid and kind of like you were speaking to this intersection of just like obsessive compulsiveness and malnutrition. We learned that through the Minnesota starvation experiment back in World War II. Where they were studying soldiers to see like how they would recover from war. And they found in that study that these are people that didn't have eating disorders, didn't have OCD, but they suddenly became like more obsessive about it and like hoarding food, watch recipes, things like that. And so we know that just all humans by default, their brains will go that way when they're malnourished.
You know, Jen, I see that sometimes too in the protective services population, which would be the foster care system here in the States, sometimes where there is that fear, I don't know where my next food is coming from. I maybe am going to hoard and save and almost like
scarcity.
Yeah, the scarcity.
And we see the same behavior, the same thing happen with a lot of kids today with the electronics. It's definitely a lot more electronics than I had when I was a child, but take your kids' electronics away, you're going to have those outbursts and things like that, and they're going to sneak them in. So that's why we do all foods fit, because we know that we don't have to have this disordered relationship about restricting food, certain types of foods and things like that. And we actually can trust ourselves to be okay, because we're not. I think there's this big myth in society that continuously gets perpetuated about, you know, like, let's go back to Halloween candy. A lot of parents freak out about Halloween candy, like, oh, my kid's just going to eat all of this candy. They're going to be so unhealthy. They have all these stories. That's their narrative. But they didn't develop this narrative on their own. They were given it from society. Society has told them that Halloween candy is bad. Your kid shouldn't have it. It's junk food. All of these kind of words to describe it. And in fact, what we know is kids who have Halloween candy, they get their Halloween candy. If they just keep it out, it's not locked up or anything like that, their interest in it fades like a week later. Like, you know,
we have so much Halloween candy.
Yeah. But I think the fear is that a lot of people get really immersed in this diet culture that becomes their own story and their own fears.
Right.
And all of these like faulty associations with like health and wellness. And that's how you kind of lead into eating disorders. This false narrative or idea that a thinner body is a healthy body. That's the thing that really promotes things like orthorexia and then also muscle-oriented disordered eating, which sometimes it could be more of a BDD presentation. This is more like toward like adolescent boys. This is kind of like how eating disorders start in them, is they get focused on bulking up and they actually perceive their bodies as like taller and lankier than they actually are. Whereas like adolescent girls might see themselves as larger than they actually are. So it's the same kind of phenomena. And then throw in some social media.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Eating disorders are a huge societal problem.
Well, and what I will say real quick too, just on something that you just mentioned, culture endorses the idea of candy bad and there are bad foods and this is unhealthy. And there's almost this idea that you're not going to be able, again, like you said, kind of projected on people, that you're not going to be able to control. Like you're going to be like, you're at a buffet of endless candy here because you went trick-or-treating. And yet there's the, you're only a child once. Their kids go trick-or-treating. Let them have some fun, but don't eat the candy, right? And it's like, what? The mixed message of go enjoy, go do this, go socialize, make friends, but every friend event, and this will lead a little bit to later in our discussion to holiday stuff, every friend event or social gathering is around what? Food. Come to the ice cream social. Come have dinner. Let's go have happy hour. Let's go. There's some kind of ingestion of some kind of drink or food, but it's also just like living, you're fueling your body. And so it so often gets labeled as both. You need to do this, but don't do that. And it's like, it's so like the juxtaposition is so hypocritical, really, in a lot of different ways. So how do you make sense of that? And so there's that. And then there are what people probably think more classically. And actually, I would say binge eating, correct me if I'm wrong, I would say binge eating in some of that projection of if you had access to your candy, you'd probably just eat it all is a bit of a projection of what could be a presentation of binge eating disorder. Would you agree with that or am I off on that?
So actually, binge eating disorder is 100% a restrictive eating disorder.
Okay, so I'm off. Please tell us more because it's actually the most common, at least from the research that I've looked at, it is the most common presentation of eating disorder.
A lot of people, and the reason I think people believe this, when they think of binge eating disorder, you know, what is that mental image in your head of like what someone with binge eating disorder might look like? Now, close your eyes and think about if I say anorexia nervosa. You probably have two distinctly different body types in your head. And in fact, when you work with eating disorders and you know eating disorders as intimately as I do, you know that maybe the larger person, they might actually have an anorexia. We can't diagnose it with the DSM-5. They call it atypical anorexia. So they get the off-bed eye, I will diagnose it. And I'll call it anorexia because that's exactly what it is. That's what we're talking about. These are mental illnesses, right? So like the mental preoccupation with food, calories, dieting, body image is so severe. We've studies showing that in larger weight bodies of having that anorexia presentation, they are more mentally consumed by this increased suicidality compared to their thin counterparts. And oftentimes what we've been taught is like, oh, it's more severe the thinner you are. And that is absolutely 100% not true. Malnutrition can occur in anybody, especially in binge eating disorder. A lot of people don't think, how could they be malnourished? It's because they probably eat the same stuff over and over again. And they're neglecting, you know, entire food groups, like vegetables, maybe.
Well, and you and I were talking before recording. To be fair, fam, I was so excited to cover all the topics. I'm like, Jenna, this. So we had a very lively conversation before we started recording, but also because of diet culture, calories in, calories out, just a number of food messaging from food companies, ingredients, etc., metabolisms have changed. And so you might have a person in a bigger body. And you would say, well, I couldn't have any eating disorder. And maybe they're barely eating. Their body, like we are at our core, our bodies aren't caught up with all the little trends. They're kind of caveman bodies at their core. And they're like, if we don't save every morsel of fuel we get, we're not going to make it through the winter. And so our bodies can hold. Like our bodies are trying to ultimately move us towards survival, right? That's their mode. And so whether your body is stereotypically thin or overly thin, whether it's normal, what's normal, right? Any of these sizes, a larger body, it's not a marker of health per se. It's not a marker of whether or not you would be struggling with a mental illness or not. And it's an error to judge based on, what's the old adage? Don't judge a book by its cover. Don't judge a book by its cover. You can't tell much from the cover other than that's the cover.
Yeah. And this narrative gets so perpetuated just by everybody. So people are like, well, listen to your doctor. And the problem is everybody who's a doctor, everybody who's a therapist, everybody's a dietitian. We all grew up in America. I mean, I'm talking about here, right? So diet culture here, it is so pervasive. So like we're bringing in those automatic appraisals into our clinical work. And it's really hard when people see actual research showing that, you know, are larger bodies the cause of these illnesses? Now, there are any correlation stuff going on, but that's not why. We have to look at social determinants of health. Like, where do people even live? I mean, we have that whole zip code life expectancy thing. Like, people are disenfranchised. And those people who are more likely to be in larger bodies. So, like, it is so much more complex than this simple narrative of you are what you eat. That's just completely false. But yet that fuels, right? You've internalized this narrative that will fuel someone eating disorder. So part of like the whole eating disorder treatment, I know before we hopped on here, we were talking a little bit about can use a little bit of ICBT with eating disorders. I'm like, absolutely. But we do have to work in the appraisal-based model of CBT too to kind of unpack this narrative that just is completely false. It is completely false. And so kind of getting back into like binge eating and things like that. What I mean by restrictive eating disorder is most people, once you talk to them about their binge eating habits, you will find out their dieting history, how they feel about their body, things like that. Or they might have ADHD and they just forget to eat or something like that. That's still restriction. So like ADHD can actually kind of trigger the onset of a BED presentation in people just because they're not eating consistently. So when people aren't eating consistently throughout the day, they're more likely to binge. And that's what we see in anorexia where, you know, they might restrict all day, maybe a whole week. They're living on very few calories. And then all of a sudden, that mentality just like, okay, I'm starved. I'm going to eat everything. And then everything starts over at midnight because, you know, in anorexia, there's a lot of rigidity, all these food rules that just do not make sense.
Right.
And they know that doesn't make sense. And that's where ICBT can be really helpful. But
well, and for your family that has been with us for a hot minute here, you're going to be like, well, that sounds familiar when you think of the functionality of OCD and how that disorder can function, particularly from a downstream approach. And, you know, for the sake of today, because we're zooming into this intersection, we're not going to spend like a ton of time on what is OCD, because we do talk about that a lot.
Yeah.
But I will say, if you're newer to understanding OCD as well, some of the main evidence-based practices that we use are ERP has been mentioned. That's exposure and response prevention. And there's also inference-based CBT. There's also emerging approaches like mastery approach that both Jenna and I are big fans of. And actually how I got introduced to Jenna, because Rich Gallagher, who has come up with the mastery approach, said, Nicole, you've got to meet Jenna. They're fantastic. And this would be a fabulous guest to talk about ED and OCD. And so I've had that stored in my mind and going, yes, 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 I need to reach out to Jenna. But it just felt like a really appropriate time, because this time of year where the holidays, and so many holidays, it's not just even one, even if you don't celebrate or participate in all of them, the hustle and bustle and the amount of parties and celebrations and programming that happens around this time of year brings in added layers of challenges. And so we're going to be definitely discussing all of that and more. But before we dive into that, anything else you wanted to say on anorexia or bulimia?
So anorexia is going to be restrictive, predominantly restrictive, but then you might see that binge purge pattern or just binging and then like compensating more with restriction than bulimia. And by the way, people switch eating disorders all the time. It's very common. And for me personally, I had anorexia. Then I went to this like orthorexic presentation. So I got that back in the day. It was called EDNOS. Now we diagnose it as OSFED. So kind of bouncing all around and like, you know, I did everything. So a lot of people do everything. And the one thing that the DS, the Curry version, doesn't really specify, we cannot diagnose both ARFID and anorexia. I will tell you that it does co-occur. People don't just magically get out of their ARFID and now they have anorexia. They kind of have those maybe sensory sensitivities going on with food too. And I actually think they're more vulnerable to developing these eating disorders when you just kind of take what I mentioned, like if someone's malnourished, well, then physiologically they're going to binge. They're going to start eating like what their body is going to want to survive.
Right.
Cannot avoid that. It's just being human. And the formula, the magic formula, is to eat consistently throughout the day. Get a dietitian. That's outside of my scope, but I work very closely with dietitians because they know food science and they know health. And that's what I do use
when we have the whole OCD stuff going on.
Is that is the reality.
Anytime you find yourself doubting this meal plan,
you're in the imagination, right? So we're going to stick to this.
Yeah. Well, and even outside of like human beings, you can see like, you know, I'm thinking of like a bear. I'm sure there's many different animals, right? But bears tend to what? Hibernate for the winter, right? And so what do they need to do to be able to be in a place to hibernate for the winter? They've got to store up food. They've probably got to preload or postload fuel for their body. And so it makes sense in that context, but we're not bears, right? And so it makes sense from a biological functionality standpoint that if you haven't eaten, then when you get up, you're going to be like, I need food. And it will be harder to gauge. And depending on how long of a period of time in which you're engaging in that, your ability to read your interoceptive cues and be able to say, oh, you know what? I'm satiated or I'm full or I'm not. Like, it's all going to be like, because you're going to be like, I'm so hungry. I've got to survive. Again, our caveman bodies are going, must eat. I need food. We're not going to make it otherwise.
Well, that's the other thing that happens with eating disorders. Not only do people become more obsessive compulsive, like they may not, you know, have actual OCD, but they have like obsessive compulsive stuff around food. They also just lose hunger, fullness, whatever is their norm, because I think I'm getting more into like all this like interoceptive stuff. And I'm like, oh, wow, not everybody experiences hunger and fullness the same. And no wonder it was so confusing when I was going through it. But like they lose what they know their cues to be are too. So refeeding can be really hard to trust because the body's just going to do stuff and it's not going to be comfortable. There's nothing comfortable about the process of refeeding from an eating disorder. It's really hard.
Yeah. And if you think even just a normalized processing where you might need supports, I'm thinking about, and I've been open with the family here about my kids are autistic. And they all have different strengths and challenges, just like any holistic folks, right? Like we all have our strengths and challenges. But understanding the interoceptive cues, part of that is just going to be like, okay, understanding and making friends with our sensory system and our neuroprocessing, right? And understanding what's not disordered, but may need support because it may be harder to discern. But OCD being opportunistic, ED also being opportunistic, can often blur the lines. So you can have a normative process, just like outside of, I would compare it to, say, hand washing. Hand washing can be a normative process. In fact, we might go, yes, that's a good hygienic process. But hand washing can also get hijacked by OCD and become a very distressing process or compulsive process. And so being able to regain a sense of what is homeostasis for me, if I am already reading my interoceptive cues or struggling to read my interoceptive cues, giving myself permission to understand my sensory system more, and then booting out OCD or ED when it's getting in the way. We know OCD can bark at us in that way. ED also very, very similar from my understanding, at least in how it can really affect the way you're constructing thoughts around and logic around what needs to happen, what to do to survive, how to feel a sense of control for oneself, etc. Would you have anything to add there?
Yeah, of course. I'm not saying it's not true, but I think the stereotype around eating disorders is that, oh, they're just trying to control everything else. It's a control. And that can be part of it. It's also a lot more complex. So some of it might just be about feeling safe.
Yeah.
It's about more like safety. Thinking about maybe people with really high ACE scores, they're more likely to develop an eating disorder, substance use, or whatever it is, because they're just not feeling safe. And the eating disorder can make people feel safe, even though it's killing them. And that's the thing that I think is really hard for people to understand, is that it does. I view anytime a client is like engaging in eating disorder symptoms, I'm not like, oh, we have to rush into higher level. It's like, okay, what are you doing to survive? Like, I work with a lot of trans and non-binary clients.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, it's a very scary time for them. And I'm not pathologizing their eating disorder symptoms like at all, because it makes sense. And I know they also value help and recovery and supplementing. Right now, we can't access that. So what do we do? And how do we get through this like really hard time and just survive? Is there like a level of disordered eating that they're okay with just to kind of get through these difficult moments? And so, of course, it's like more of a harm reductionist approach. And I do find that that is incredibly helpful, because it can almost feel like you're being flooded with recovery. If it's like, I only follow what the dietitian says and stuff like that, it's not, recovery's not perfect. It's going to be imperfect. You're going to mess up. Can we practice self-compassion? Can we radically accept that life is really hard sometimes?
Yeah. And I'm thinking about even from safety, you know, I'm thinking from the autistic standpoint, from a lot of different diverse intersections, safety is so core, right? Mm-hmm. It's so core. And so sometimes even the process of masking can get in the way of being able to make some different choices. And, you know, the person sitting across from them may not know why all the different variables that go into why they feel like they need to mask, and they probably have needed to mask.
Eating disorder is just a form of masking, because it's, I know for me as an autistic individual, being able to talk about diets and wellness and fitness and all of that kind of stuff, that was, I hate small talk. This is why I really enjoyed our conversation today. Like, I really just don't like small talk. But when I started to develop an interest in like food and nutrition and stuff, and of course I took it to the extreme, but I felt like I could socially connect with people, because how many people are on diets just listening to this podcast? You probably are. There's a lot of you right now dieting.
Or if not dieting, thinking I need to go on the diet. Oh, we're getting through the holiday season. Oh, there's going to be cookies and there's going to be parties and there's going to be the things.
How else for like someone to just be able to participate in those conversations? I will tell you, like, just from my lived experience, I felt so connected to people when I was able to talk about this stuff and getting those appraisals like, oh, you're so good, or oh, you don't eat that, or that's so, that felt so good. So there's also that, like, there's little dopamine hits too when people are engaging in their eating disorder. And what's really sad is the people around them don't know that this person is really mentally struggling.
Yeah.
They're not well, and they're killing themselves. And we're also just like kind of reinforcing that behaviors. And that is the biggest challenge for the holiday season, is a lot of people are going to be going to dinners or parties with family members and friends who are ingrained in diet culture. And how do you navigate those very triggering spaces?
Mm-hmm. And sometimes people that are even pointing it out, you're so good, again, are people struggling with it as well. And they're going, you know, there's so much guilt and shame too that comes up, where people go, oh, I couldn't resist the cookie, but they could, or whatever the thing is. It doesn't even have to be a cookie. Again, the conceptualization is as varied and creative as the people living with the experience, as we say with OCD too. It can present in so many different ways. And so it is a real problem that can come up. And what we see too within OCD is, whether it's from a contamination space, and I hesitate to, like, I realize all the examples so far I've brought up of OCD go to a contamination, which it's not just about contamination, right? But even emotional contamination space of feeling like I can't be present in the same space. It's not even about the food. But if you're never leaving your room, if your world has gotten very, very small and you have very limited access, there's a little more options nowadays with having food delivered to the house, etc. But we can see how all of these different disorders and different aspects and challenges can really complicate the clinical picture. I think, too, another thing just to highlight that you mentioned and I think is important, and it feels daunting, it feels scary, right? But it's really important to not sugarcoat. Eating disorders, people are at risk of dying in eating disorders, and not just from suicide risk, from complicating health factors that result from malnutrition, that can result from a number of different cardiac issues, complicating factors. And so it feels really scary, because especially we have parents that'll be listening and they'll be like, oh my, what do I do? Like, I don't want this to be a lethal thing. I'm really worried about it. And one of the best things we can do is have these conversations and increase our understanding and awareness about how these function and what kind of help is needed, so that we can get our loved ones the support that they need. And so as we go into this intersection, and if OCD and eating disorder are present, a little bit is going to depend on your clinician's ability to know And sometimes we as family members might even feel like I have to know what all the options could be in case my clinician doesn't know, which is so much. It's so overwhelming. And so first of all, just in thinking about this co-occurring diagnostic presentation, what are some things that might be helpful for folks with lived experience or family members concerned about their loved ones to consider in terms of the clinical assessment and creating that picture?
So I think for family members, one of the things I do is space. Some of that's parent anxiety is so high around this. Yes, they're lethal. They are. They're very lethal. And you need to be proactive. At the same time, we can't force recovery on the child or whoever it is. Recovery really has to be motivated from that person if they want to. The eating disorder, like as a therapist, right? Like what is the function of the eating disorder? That can shift things like that, but it is serving a purpose in life. And it's scary. It's scary to give up an eating disorder, especially if you've been struggling with it for like 10 years, 20 years, however long it's been. It's really scary to give up an eating disorder because in a way, like the eating disorder becomes this like constant, consistent thing that you just know. You know, it's like, well, I don't have to think about school or my job anymore. I can just focus on my calories, but it's a big distraction. So you can just kind of exist your life and maybe avoid adulting or whatever it is. And it can be just really hard. And so I think for parents or any family members to just validate how scary it is to let go of that eating disorder, like that validation is really key. And then also doing emotion coaching, even if you don't really understand your loved one's behavior, you know, just like try to bring them down that elevator because like when they're freaking out about whatever is on their plate or something like that, just like, hey, I see that this is really hard for you and I love you and blah, 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 blah. Just bring them down because you can't logic with eating disorders and those very intense emotional experiences. You just can't. And maybe, you know, talk to them later on about that. So asking them, do they want help? It depends on like, you know, what age are we talking about with people? But with recovery, you can't just force someone into treatment. I think the biggest thing that parents slip up on is they drop their kid off at a treatment center and they think insurance is like, okay, 30 days. It's with the plan card. Like, okay, in 30 days, I'll get my kid back.
They'll be fixed.
Right. It's going to be fixed. It's not. It just, eating disorders are really, 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 really hard to recover from. The earlier you intervene, the better that prognosis is. That is very consistent across the board. So knowing the signs, right, for families, you know, knowing the signs, what to look for in your loved one. There are a lot of things that are very, to me, because of my own experience in this, both like personally and professionally, I can see the red flags very, very easily. However, most people are like, oh, that's normal. That's normal because diet culture and eating disorders share a lot in common. So it's just like, where do you go from disordered eating and full-blown eating disorder? And I think being able to see those red flags can be really helpful to get the loved one help because then you're kind of naming it in the moment. So like if you are a parent and it's age appropriate to check their electronics, like what's their TikTok feed look like? What kind of videos?
What's the For You page?
You know, because if you know, what does the algorithm know about your kid? That you may not know about your kid, that algorithm knows more about your kid. Oh, what I eat in 24 hours or all the Fitspiration videos, things like that, muscle building, whatever it is, those are red flags, parents. Those are huge, huge red flags. And the way that you can talk to your kids about it too is like, don't let them think that it's their fault. Place this blame off society because it's, like I said before, like a societal issue that like, hey, I know you really like watching TikTok. There's a lot of cool stuff on TikTok. You know, there's Lego videos or Minecraft or whatever. And because it knows that you're this age, the algorithm has picked up that at this age, you're starting to have all these hormones and things like that, that you're going to have more body image stuff pop up. And so they're going to take advantage of it. So teach your kids, get them the skills. What is the internet trying to sell me? Because they're even trying to sell you a product, right? How much money does the dieting industry get kids angry with this capitalistic crap that pulls people into eating disorders? I think that's like a really good way, but just look for those red flags. What are they asking for the holidays? Do they want exercise equipment? Do they want like, I don't know, special blenders, gym membership, whatever? It's going to look suspicious. And not everything's a symptom. That's where if you are highly anxious parents, regulate your own anxiety because not every red flag means there's a problem. It's just like, okay, Something may not be right.
Yeah, if anything, allow yourself to be curious, and maybe you're finding out more information from them in terms of what they're doing or from seeking a consultation with a professional or asking your pediatrician or family doctor, should I be concerned about this? Sometimes it's not always on the radar.
A tricky piece, sometimes parents do have to advocate for their pediatricians, especially if their kid is in a higher weight body, to take them seriously. Because, you know, like I said earlier, like these pediatricians, they often grew up in diet culture. They might be dieting. They may be really ingrained in this mentality and haven't really seen the research that like a lot of the people, like eating disorder professionals have seen.
I'm just even thinking about for a client who, hi, client, I'm sure you're listening, that has recently dealt with this. And I'll just say, to the extent that the doctor's office was like, that doesn't sound like an eating disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very glad that I got to see my client and be like, I don't care what they think. I mean, it's not that, and I don't want to give the impression, and it's not my scope of practice to do the medical, but for the presenting symptoms, whether it's us therapists, when it's doctors, are dismissive of it and say, it's not what that is. And we see that in the OCD field all the time too. What? I don't think that's OCD. Do you wash your hands a lot? Do you go in and out of doorways
a lot?
I mean,
right.
There's so much misunderstanding. So helping, sometimes it means you as the family member need somebody that can kind of cheerlead you along and go, oh, don't worry about that. Just go get your person the support they need.
Mm-hmm.
Let's find somebody for the team that does understand that. Because if your pediatrician doesn't, you need a teammate here in this process that is going to understand it.
And making sure that when you are like hiring a team for like your kid, you're getting a HAZE-aligned non-diet dietitian. That is so important. They actually, this is a really fun fact. I'm not sure the exact percentage, but a high percentage of dietetic students have that orthorexic thing going on.
Interesting.
So they have to unlearn that. So some registered dietitians may not be safe providers for people with eating disorders until they've really unlearned diet culture. That case of like any, you know, therapist or dietitian is listening. If you do want to dig into eating disorders, the number one thing to do to start getting experience in this work is on learning what's your relationship with food and body. And I've learned so much from people in larger bodies who've experienced so much weight stigma and learning about health at every side from the science behind, you know, like we are not what we eat. That is just false. It's not calories in, calories out. It's just not. There's thin privilege. How many people do you know that you would think they may not look as thin as they are? So, you know what I'm saying? Like,
right.
Where you're like,
they're thin but unhealthy because, yeah, they might have high cholesterol or whatever because they're eating whatever, but they're not thin because of what they're eating. It's because of genetics. Right. They have that privilege.
Not also, like I was saying, there's social determinants of health, looking at like complex trauma and how that turns on some of these metabolic things. And then, of course, past experience of any type of dieting, like weight cycling, which we would see is going to trigger a lot of metabolic problems.
Which how much, like, and I'm not saying this is only like a female problem, but I can just think like through my family, through growing up, how particularly was there a focus on being thin? That's what's attractive. And it's not just for women, but I can only speak to my own experience that so many people have yo-yoed over the course of their life. The battle of the bulge, all of this diet culture that's been going on for decades has real effects, not only on what the scale says, it's so much deeper than what the scale says, but how it affects our metabolism, how it can affect our overall health, how have these lasting impacts that ripple far beyond the restrictive diet or elimination diet that somebody tried for a season. And in this time of year, one of the things that you brought up as we were just getting ready to meet today, Jenna, is we're approaching New Year's. And it's kind of a common thing where people are like, screw resolutions, because we never keep resolutions, right? But they still do their own kind of resolution or image board or word or theme or whatever. And a lot of people, and if you work at a gym, you know this very well, or if you work out at a gym, you know it gets really crowded. And the new year, people are like, this year's going to be different. We're going to exercise more. We're going to lift more. We're going to eat differently. And there's some extreme reactions that generally don't last for a very long season, but they have some really big impacts. And so, again, part of this holiday season includes even going into a new year and going, what are some of the things that I need to fix about myself? And it's a fixed mentality, right? Diet culture is a fixed mentality. If you just do this, you feel better. And ED is like, yeah, I can jump into that and really amplify the noise around that. But it is a mental health disorder, as you're saying.
Yes, because you just, that's all that you can think about. And it's really pervasive in our society. And this is where it gets into, I would even argue that like most Americans are probably engaging in disordered eating. And that's the social norm. Just because it's normal doesn't mean it's good. So I was just thinking about when my dad got an aphid diagnosis. He's like, well, a lot of my friends have aphid. I'm like, Dad, that's serious. Like, we got to take this stuff seriously. Like, just because like your friends have it doesn't mean that it's not a problem. So, you know, like just because everyone else is doing it doesn't mean that that's okay either. And so, yeah, there's definitely that fix it mentality. And thinking about, you know, business and marketing uses psychology. They take understanding human behavior to market us to buy these products, basically for them to make money off of us hating ourselves.
And not accepting ourselves, not loving ourselves. And it used to be back in the day, we'd compare all this versus Photoshop.
Yeah.
But now we look at augmented reality and we look at AI and here is perfection created in a moment. And this is what we have to compare ourselves to. Perfection is not a thing. We're never going to be able to be, even if we feel like I had a moment, it's a moment. It's not a place where we can land and stay in terms of looking a certain way, feeling a certain way. It's very, very complex. But AI would say, or augmented reality or filters on social media would say, if I had a little more defined cheekbone and I had wider eyes and lashes and all the different things that filters can do, then it'd be better. Mm-hmm. This is like, you got to realize like most people out there don't even look like what they're projecting. Again, back to projection, because they're afraid to put themselves out there for who they really are. They're augmenting a version of themselves. And that's who's gaining followers and who's becoming influencers. I'm not saying all influencers are that way, but it's a big, big problem. So what's even real? We might go, oh, well, I want to be normal. Or maybe I am normal, and maybe normal is something that needs to shift, isn't necessarily healthy. But even our idea of normal is based on a lot of augmented reality.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there's an app called Be Real. Are you familiar with that one?
No, tell me.
It's a great app. I recommend it for everybody, honestly, because it helps us get out of every day at any point of the day. It'll text you. I miss my Be Real. I miss it all the time because I have my notifications muted when I'm seeing clients. So yeah. Like I'm new it like on Saturday and Monday. But it's a really cool app because basically it responds a day. It's like, all right, it's time to be real. And you have 10 seconds to snap a photo, something like 10 seconds or whatever, of what you're doing. And it's not just a photo of like you. It's like what you're seeing. So it takes your, you know, with your phone, you can do like your selfie and like what you're actually seeing at the same time. And that's your photo and you post in, you know, you have your friends and things like that. It's a really good practice, like a daily practice to do where you're just being real. There's no time to Photoshop. There's no time for filters. There's no time for any of that big stuff. It's awesome. It is so, I use it like just because I think it's just helpful because, yeah, like I'm laying in bed right now. Like, let's just be real, you know?
I love that. Be present too. It kind of reminds me even in, you know, as we think about like inference-based CBT, how to be present, take in the sensory data. We're not changing the story at all. And so many of the filters are changing the story. It's not what you see. And so yeah. I liked that it really has that present emphasis on it. That's awesome. So I'm going to link that over on the blog too, you guys, because I think that's worth checking out, that app Be Real. I'm sure it's available for Apple and for Android and all of that. Let me ask you this too, and I kind of have this thought. I wonder when you were talking about the dietitians and some of the prevalence that is observed in the population of providers. I also wonder too sometimes, and I'm mindful of, to what degree can we differentiate? And in some circumstances, it's going to overlap, but something like a spin where we might have a special interest, we really want to, or a monotropic interest, and really want to zoom into health and nutrition versus like orthorexia, where it can get too restrictive because I think part of that could be very value driven, right? You know, and go, oh, I want to learn more. I want to learn more, more, more. And that's what made me think about it in terms of some of the dietitians going into that field. And when does that cross the line from interest to obsessive?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And I'm thinking more along the lines of, you know, what are the behaviors manifesting from all that research? Like, is this just a deep dive for fun to kind of learn, or thinking about how you might do things a little bit differently? Or are we even getting more that I'm thinking OCD, how OCD can kind of come up with the, oh, microplastics. Oh, well, now I never drink from, you know, like,
yeah,
that kind of stuff, like where it gets really extreme. So it like, what point does it like kind of start to feel extreme where it's getting in the way of your life and your functioning? That's all you're thinking about. And you're so limited and rigid that, you know, you're not eating stuff that you would have. Like, can you go to, for the food piece, can you go to a birthday and have cake? The answer is, oh, we have a problem.
Yeah. Unless you don't like cake. Right. But can you have some kind of sweet?
Right.
I just said that because I've never really loved cake, but I am all for dessert. So I'm not, it's not because it's dessert.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do know what you're saying.
You know, are you now like not allowing yourself to have fun, essentially? Are you imagining that it's going to destroy your body overnight? And now, you know, whatever disease, something, I don't know, like people come up with a really interesting story when they, because they start to like do research and, you know, like, oh, this could do this could do that or whatever. It's like, it could, it's just like, but are we doing that every single meal, every single snack, whatever?
Right. Yeah. You know, one I've heard often is I can't have the cake because then I'll gain like 3 pounds. And it's like from the one piece of cake, which calorically
called inferential confusion.
Is that how that works?
Eating disorder, that is exactly how it feels.
Right.
You're in the bubble. There's a bubble there. You feel like it's really happening. It's going to happen. And you have to avoid the compulsion there when being avoided. So I'm going to avoid it. It's so, so similar.
Yeah. And if you're newer to the podcast or newer to learning about or understanding ICBT, inferential confusion is a meaty concept, but essentially imagine we're saying confused conclusion. That you would come to the confused conclusion that just having one piece of cake is going to have this effect. And it's based and fueled in the imagination where you're like, oh, I can imagine that because I had this cake, now my body's going to be destroyed from this. And it's going to have a feared impact in that situation. In the example we're using, the feared impact would be gaining weight, etc. So if you want to learn more about inferential confusion or ICBT or even ERP, again, I'll link some episodes that cover that psychoeducation really well, because how they conceptualize OCD are very different. And so it's worth hearing both ways in terms of how that's conceptualized as some of our main treatment models. But as we've talked about, there are some other developing models as well. And we're more aware, at least I'm more aware of what's available in the OCD world. So when it comes to ED, could you help shed some light on what is recommended for treatment, for support, even diagnostic measures? I know I have my chicken scratch here. I think the EDEQ short form has been a measure for eating disorder that I've learned about, but I would love to know what you would recommend in terms of people getting support for eating disorder for treatment. And again, we're talking about the mental health therapy, but there's the team to support that you would want to draw in there.
Yeah. Okay. You have the EDEQ. There's also the 826. And I think none of these measures are really looking at like ARFIDs specifically. So I actually just did a presentation last week where I came up with just some questions to kind of like dig into, like, oh, is this ARFID? And one of the things for ARFID that I look for is, and this is not like a magic number, it's just kind of what I, where I'm at clinically right now is like 20. So does the person have only 20 safe foods? And then you might be looking at ARFID. And by safe foods, I mean, like, if someone eats cereal and oatmeal, there's not much diversity there. So, you know, like mac and cheese, chicken tenders, pizza, whatever it is, those are their own things. The French fries is not really its own food. I'm thinking like 20 different meals. Even less than that, but they can rotate through. They're probably getting into ARFID, and definitely, you know, take them to their pediatrician, see if there's any malnutrition going on where they might need some support to kind of like boost up that nutrition. And so that's that piece with kind of screening. But for eating disorders, we're looking for more like the anorexia, binge eating, bulimia. We're looking for how much time completely forget that there's any physical manifestation at being. I think once we like get that image out of our mind, like the Karen Carpenter, like all of that, like take it out of your mind and ask your client, like, how much time are you thinking about this? Like, what is your thought process? How do you feel about your body? What do you want to change? Do you want to change your body? That's what you're really trying to dig into. And that's how you know you're dealing with an eating disorder. So then what's the difference between someone dieting, which that's why I would classify it as disordered eating. Most people dieting have poor body image. They're trying to change it. But like, how much time is it consuming them mentally? How obsessive, how extreme are they kind of getting into this?
Jenna, to paint a picture of this, I remember a past client who's since graduated, love that, but that came in like grumpy as all get out, which was valid because the last thing they wanted to talk about was eating disorder. The referral was coming in for OCD, but I was very quickly confident that it wasn't just OCD. OCD might have been there. We needed to do some work and see if it was there, and it ended up not being there once the person was in a better, more stable weight. But what I would say is the last thing they wanted to do is come talk to me about food. And they were doing family-based treatment for their eating disorder, which is a very, from my understanding at least, a very loose kind of boundaried tiered system of treatment that has its place but doesn't have a lot of guidance and direction. And so with the nutrition plan that they had from their nutritionist and the amount of snacks and how much they had to take in and now coming into therapy, we added it up. And there were like, I can't even remember, but it was an obscene amount of hours that were focused, even if the client wasn't in a compulsion around food, focused on calories being consumed. Mm-hmm. And it was like, yeah, no wonder. Not that you, aside from this, I mean, I'd be thrilled at the fact that you feel forced into treatment. But at the same time, like, we're spending so much of your day, even for treatment, occupied on how much you're eating. And I can imagine, if anything I can offer you is how can we get people off your back and get you some more space and freedom to not have to think about it so much. And that was our in for starting treatment together. But it is like, if you actually add it up, we do this when we do Y-box and Psy-box in terms of OCD measurements. So for anybody new, that's the Yale-Brown Obsessive Compulsive Scale and the children version as well for Psy-box. Part of how we diagnose that, there has to be a certain amount of time that occupies in a day. And for some people, that can be really hard to kind of imagine, like how much of my day is occupied by a certain compulsion or obsession. I don't know, like it doesn't all happen at once. But for people, when you look back over their eating and the preoccupation with what they're eating or exercising or body image, et cetera, it's a lot.
It's a full-time,
yes, super time.
And where does it start to really impair their functioning? These are other things to kind of look for. Like, is social eating something they usually enjoy and now, like, they're saying no because they're scared of the food or they won't be able to eat there because of the eating disorder voice? Also, just asking them, like, how loud is that eating disorder voice? That voice that kind of tells you that you need to not eat this, do that, or whatever to compensate. Kind of looking at, like, how much space is this taking up? And also some of the behavior stuff, like we see with our health anxiety and OCD clients that fall down the Reddit hole. Just how are you really spending on Reddit? We have screen time, right? Check your screen time on your phone to really see, like, how much time am I, like, deep diving into all this, like, nutritional science on Reddit if they have, like, that orthorexia going on. Or their YouTube or TikTok and, you know, how much content are they seeing? And another behavior that you'll see is just, like, back during that Minnesota starvation experiment, is like the obsession with like cooking or just food and stuff like that. We call it like food porn on honey watching.
Yeah.
Not just like cooking videos. I know like I was a big Food Network person back in the day. That was my thing. And like that's like mentally substituting. Well, if I'm not going to eat, then I'm going to watch this. Or are they the kind of person who will prepare food for everybody else, but then they don't really eat?
Yeah.
That is a huge sign. Other things are these things called mukbangs. Have you heard of them?
No.
Where they watch just people eating a lot of food to kind of like reverse trigger that to like not do that or like both ways actually. So it's very similar to like people with neurotic excoriation watching like the pimple popping video. It's the same kind of phenomena.
Yeah.
Where people just like watching people just eat tons and tons of food.
Yes.
These are other things to look for to see if someone's like really gone into the territory of an eating disorder. And also like, do they feel like it's an eating disorder? I know I practice a little bit differently than the way I was trained because I don't like labeling people until it's like a collaborative approach, especially because I do like ADHD and autism assessments. It's like, all right, do you think this fits? Based on this is what the DSM-5 says and this is what, you know, I'm gathering from you. Do you agree that this is an eating disorder?
Yeah.
Because like if they don't, then they're not going to want to work on it if they don't even see it as a problem.
Right.
Well, and that's what probably makes things tricky if you are a parent to a kid with an eating disorder. Like the parent knows this is an eating disorder. The kid's not really going to see that. So in their own time, they'd be like, okay, I don't really like this anymore. But a lot of the times in the beginning of an eating disorder, people might feel more productive. You get high from restriction. People predispose genetically to have like anorexia. We've actually seen that the way that their metabolism works is that most people experience hunger as I'm so hungry, I need to eat, I'm getting irritable. Then you have this other experience where, and this can change, but I used to be the kind where like, I would not eat and I got high, literally like just like a, like kind of like a runner's high. I can explain it a little better. Or you're just like, oh, I feel great. Everything's wonderful. I'm getting straight A's. I'm very productive. It's great.
And there's things like autophagy and things. And so it gets complicated with some of these different health factors that get cherry picked and out of context, as we learn in ICBT, these out of context facts can become really problematic for drawing these conclusions and irrelevant associations. And so it really takes linking and consulting with people that understand how that fits in context. And could some of this be happening? Yeah, but not in this context.
That's the thing I work with like parents too, is like, are you just kind of jumping to this conclusion? And I see this more when their kid has had an eating disorder. And then like the kid's doing other stuff, like maybe kid is like undiagnosed autistic and they've always had weird little oddities around food or something like that, where they're like, I don't want to eat that or that smells weird or whatever. But not everything's an eating disorder symptom. So then you have the parents that are like kind of like react to that, like, oh, they're restricting again. They're like feeling like they're going to lose their kid. And it's so, so scary to experience that fear because, again, like I'm not going to sugarcoat it. Eating disorders are incredibly deadly. I know.
Right.
I've had like very, very close experiences to death because of my eating disorder. And even if you get there, it's so weird because you're like, wow, this thing really can kill you. So if you're younger or it doesn't really matter, I guess there's that invincibility. Like, oh, it's not going to happen to me. It's not going to happen to me. But then maybe you go to a treatment center and you're like, oh my gosh, this person just died from their eating disorder. What if that happens to me? And that's a good inference to me.
Yeah,
that's a very good inference where you're like, oh, wow, like this is getting more real. Like, I'm not invincible. I'm human. And this can absolutely kill me.
Well, and it's an inference made in reality. That's the core difference, right? Because it's filling in the blank and the understanding based on direct evidence, which is different than when our minds fill in the blank based on what's possible and imagined. And especially when you have something like OCD in the mix, where it's going to imagine so many dire circumstances. But ED also can have a really loud, bossy voice. And so understanding that, A, whether it's your loved one or you dealing with it, you don't have to be alone in that. There is a lot of different support out there that can be helpful. And so reaching out and finding somebody. And if you live in a state where you're like, gosh, there's nobody really great, nothing's really coming up in my Google search, then even coming in, and I wonder if you would have some tips for what people can ask, whether they go to a doctor or a therapist. Sometimes I've seen it both ways. I've seen where people have gone to the doctor and I love if therapy gets cued in, you might want to go to a therapist. But also I've seen clients come to me first and I'm like, you know what? We really need to get you to the doctor. And so just even helping family members know how to navigate that, like what kind of questions to ask.
I think the first thing, like returning back way to the doctors, is the biggest secret is that you don't have to get weighed at the doctors. They'll tell you that you do have to get weighed. And I know that like people can still be biased just looking at someone, but sometimes that like makes it just feel safer for people to feel like they can be taken seriously. So people can refuse to get weighed. I think for insurance, they need 3 health measures. So you could do that with your blood pressure, heart rate, and height. There, they got it. No weight. Weight's not required. But also like, you know, seeing if their doctor is receptive and for more information on this, if they don't feel like they are being taken seriously or if they're told that, oh, so you struggle with overeating when they're struggling with like quite the opposite. And like, you know, the prescription for Ozempic, I mean, that's not going to land well. So maybe you just need to find another doctor. That's fine too.
Yeah.
If you're not being heard. And Diane, like I said, with the dietitians and even therapists, like you really want to make sure their HAEs align, that help at every size. That's the key. And the third thing is just like, I think a lot of people with marketing, they'll say their HAEs aligned and they're not. So it's really hard to like vet people.
Yeah.
And so I see like people like, oh, I'm neuroaffirming. And it's like, no, you aren't. Like buzzwords now with marketing. So that's really trippy. So, you know, trusting yourself, great skill to have, right? Where you can like, maybe this therapist doesn't really get this. I'm going to try someone else.
Yeah. Something I was just thinking is useful in the conversation because we have had a huge incline in metabolic disorders, but then the overuse or misuse of GLP-1 medications that can absolutely feed into eating disorder and diet culture thinking, which also complicates the situation because if you're diabetic or if you have a metabolic issue and your doctor just determines this would be a medical necessary intervention, I'm not going to come between people and their doctors, but there's celebrities that are size zero taking Ozempic and it's become a fad as well as an easy, get thin, quick type of aid.
Yeah, and it definitely with Ozempic, I mean, it's a very big, like, hot topic right now in the eating disorder world. And Ozempic is, it's a wonderful drug for diabetes. At the same time, these problems that people are having on them, like the side effects are looking pretty bad, is that with that weight loss, just that side effect of weight loss, which people are going on for it, like the intention's just wrong. And then when they do go on it, they're going to lose the weight. And we have research showing over and over again that like 95% of people, anytime they lose weight, they're going to gain it back plus more later on. So they go through weight cycling. And that's where you see these metabolic issues. I know for most families, like my clients, they're going to dinner tables with people talking about not just their latest diets, but how great Ozempic is. And it's just incredibly harmful, again, because the intention behind it is not to manage diabetes, it's just to lose weight. And we know from years and years and years of just these bad diets that this is not healthy.
Yeah. Tell me if I'm off on this recommendation, but, and I've received this feedback from past client family members, and we'll mention this as an idea for support for when I have clients come in, is a lot of the parent groups, which you have to take with a grain of salt, they're not medical professionals, but a lot of the parent groups have been through the ropes of tricky practitioners that don't understand the clinical picture, feeling like they're on a waiting list and they're not getting support, and they finally get a meeting or they finally get an appointment and they took some blood work, took a weight and sent them back. And so sometimes even having those parent groups where parents can go like, I don't know what to do. And another parent can say like, you're not alone in this. And have you tried this? And be able to share resources or ideas in terms of not just taking the comment, you know, whether it's on Reddit or a Facebook group or whatever, but taking that recommendation and realizing, okay, now I can seek out this resource because this avenue didn't turn out very well for me. And parent groups will be very like ride or die for each other. So if they think you're with a shit clinician, they'll be like, you need to find a different clinician or same with doctor, nutritionist, etc. And sometimes just having that support, again, not replacing therapy or treatment teams with that, but having that support can be so helpful.
Parents absolutely need support around this because there's nothing harder to see than like your kid starving themselves to death, like literally. That's what's happening, or just working themselves out, whatever they're doing. It's just, it's so, so hard to see that. And the same thing happens too with kids with ARFID, like parents, there's that instinct where it's like, oh my God, they have to eat. They're going to die, right? Like hardwired into us. That doesn't go away. That's what I'm saying. Like when, like working with parents, it's like, all right, let's manage mom and dad's or anxiety or mom and moms or dad and dads or whoever the family in, right? Like we have to manage your anxiety because the kid most likely is going to soak that up like a sponge. And then you're going to get more disordered eating and stuff like that.
And I can say this, even had well-intentioned family members come to me and say, well, if the kid refuses to eat anything else but one of these 20 food groups, if you even have a list that vast, then they're going to get their way. And in my day and age, you made what was for dinner and that's what they needed. And if they didn't need it, you know, eventually they'd get hungry enough. And you and I were discussing, that's not true. I mean, you're going to end up in the hospital with a malnourished, maybe failure to thrive or dehydrated, severely sick individual with that mentality. And so sometimes there's a backlash of, oh, culture today is too soft and we baby the kids too much and all of this. But when you're dealing with something like ARFN, it's not about babying. It is about this child or individual, and usually it's in childhood. It's less likely that it would just show up, and you correct me if I'm wrong, in adulthood. It can follow you into adulthood, but it's less likely to just manifest in adulthood. But this child is not going to just eat anything. And it's a very scary thing, I can say, as a parent.
That's also, too, where parents need support, specifically with, like, ARFID and stuff, is because we want to accommodate. So a fed kid is better than, like, an unfed kid, like, regardless. And I know I shared with you earlier, I'm a parent as well. And I have some selective eaters here. And my little one, specifically, he looks at it like, no, I'm not going to do it or whatever. And I accept this no, like, okay, if ARFN5 is window of tolerance, I don't push. I know if you're like OCD trained, like in the ERP, it's like, no, we got it. It's like when he's ready to do it, he's going to do it, like giving him that autonomy to do this stuff. But for now, I'm just going to switch it up and like, okay, he still needs to get vegetables. We're going for the baby food pouch.
Yeah.
It tastes good to him and it's a texture he likes and he gets the nutrients. So you always want to accommodate that stuff until like they're ready to start. And these ARFID kids may not want to start making changes until maybe adolescence, when they're like realizing like, all my friends are going out to this sushi restaurant. Sushi looks really weird and scary. And that's where that motivation's going to come. So they can kind of like start to do their hierarchy and exposures and stuff on their own terms, but with like actual nutritional guidance, like this is what your body needs to focus. And then mom or dad, whoever, can try to get, you know, other vitamins or whatever. That's why dietitians are so, so critical, because they really understand what the body needs to function.
Yeah, it's interesting because with one of our kids, we did feeding therapy and it was so interesting. And there were SLPs, because not everybody understands, but SLPs do a lot with kind of the mouth structure and the swallowing and all of that. And if you gag when you swallow something and that scares you, which understandably any of us have ever gagged on food, you're like, oh my gosh, oh, that's not a fun experience. And so if that's a part of the ARFID picture, then having a SLP there, speech and language pathologist, an OT, mental health, and it was so...
Love OTs. They are my favorite.
I do, too. In fact, I have a girlfriend that was on the podcast last season that works at Children's Hospital Los Angeles as an OT in their ARFID clinic. And so very, very knowledgeable. And it's amazing, just incredible work that OTs do.
Well, this also gets into when we think about, you know, if you view any type of fear around that adverse consequence within ARFID about like, oh, I don't want to gag or whatever because it's uncomfortable. They know it's uncomfortable. So that's where we do need to move into these other interventions to kind of help them, because there is something different about their mouth structure or whatever it is preventing them from doing the thing. And then that's how you can work with that anxiety to like, okay, I can trust my body now.
Well, and in feeding therapy, too, what was interesting is knowing what I know now, it was very much a gradual kind of exposure method where even if you weren't eating it, they were having you play with it. And, you know, they would find a commonality. It was a group of kids. They would find one preferred food that at least all of them would eat, right? So that you start off with a win. They had a no thank you plate, so nobody had to eat it. And then they would graduate. I think veggie straws were one of them. So they're like, okay, a veggie straw is long and it has a tougher texture. So now we're going to do the next thing as long, but a little slightly different texture. And again, even if all they did was like touch it to put it on the no thank you plate or play, yes, it starts to break down some of that tactile defensiveness. It starts to get them at least exploring different textures. And, you know, so many parents will be like, well, if they just tried, you know, fill in the blank. I know they would love it. It's not about
it. It was right when your kid, like, they try something. Last night we had with the little win or whatever with the tortellini, because my partner got the tricolored tortellini. So, you know, that's going to trigger that, like, automatic, like, oh, what is this orange thing? What is this green thing?
Right.
Tortellini is white or cream or whatever. When he put one in his mouth, of like, that's amazing. Like, doing it on their own is really important. And then we also kind of encourage, like, there's nothing wrong with playing with food or in a non-coercive way. It's not like, okay, here's your green beans, play with them. It's like, if you want to play with it, you can. So then I like put it on your plate and you can do whatever you want with it. And that curiosity, because that's the thing that's going to break down past all that rigidity about like, my brain says no. And it's like, maybe not. I don't know. And so letting them kind of do it on their own. And you have these little wins, but like with the tortellini last night, I might be served out again tonight or even in 3 days from now, because that just don't add that back into the like normal rotation of foods.
Go into like just the brand stuff that he's used to and then like, you know, kind of feel it out. So that's the biggest mistake I think people do make, is where they just toss it back into that like immediate rotate. Like, right. Well, you liked it last time. It's like, oh,
right.
We don't want to do that.
Or even with familiar foods, preferred foods, that they get tired of eating and they start food jagging and then going, but this is one of your foods and we can't lose another food, so you're gonna eat it kind of thing. And guess what? Guess how that's gonna go? Do you think they're gonna eat it? Anybody who's gone through potty training knows this too, right? There are a few things that we have absolutely no control over making another person do. If they're gonna actually eat this thing or making them pee or poop. You can barter the entire world and it's still, if anything, it's going to add more pressure to the situation. But it's still like ultimately that person has to choose and they have autonomy. Even if they're your 2-year-old kid, they have autonomy. So we have to respect that you're your own person and be curious about the reason why. There's always a reason why. People don't just not do something for no reason. Even in the case where there's no motivation, the reason is there's a lack of motivation. There's always a reason why. So yeah, being curious is really important. Having those supports as a parent, and it's not just parents. It can be as partners, spouses. It can be adult children of older parents. I've seen some of this too with aging parents as they might develop different medical conditions and stuff. Their motivation to eat might really change. And so this can become a challenge at any age. It can be a young baby and it can be an elder adult. And so it's something important to be mindful of. And when we start thinking about particularly preteens, teens, and maybe even college age students, but when we start thinking about schools, some of the things they're going to cover in health class, some of the emphasis on whether the school lunch is healthy or not, or maybe they're at an age where they can select to do their standard lunch or get some of these a la carte options. Any tips for helping parents navigating teens and tweens through managing eating disorder and OCD, yes, but eating disorder in the school setting?
Yeah, so the nutritional education that most kids are going to get in public schools is not going to be consistent with what we know from the eating disorder field. So it's also going to be influenced by diet culture, who's kind of controlling the narrative about what gets taught in school. So there's going to be a lot of, this is a good food, this is a bad food, healthy versus unhealthy. That dichotomy is really hard for kids that are maybe more the inflexible kind of thinkers. So that's going to stick with them. And so I think as parents, you know, being very careful, like when, you know, your kid is getting, like if the school does things like the BMIs where they get weighed in front of their classmates or announce their BMI, they get BMI report cards. This is a thing in some areas of our country. So this needs to stop so you can, you know, see what you can do to make sure your kid's not being subjected to BMI report cards. Also, if there's any type of assignment where your kid is asked to track their calories for a day or even a week, that can be so, so damaging. That has to stop. So there's a lot of advocacy that parents can do to put an end to this that's perpetuating diet culture and also kind of feeding the development and maintenance of eating disorders. And think about, like, you know, someone does this, like, tracking of their calories, they're going to compare out to their peers because that's what developmentally they're going to do. And that's how all of this can kind of start. And we often say in eating disorder field that eating disorders are competitive. So it's like, okay, how am I going to be more extreme than my other friend or things like that? And it's so, I usually don't use this word, but it's toxic and it needs to stop. So as a parent, definitely look to see, like, how does your school teach nutrition? How do they even talk about eating disorders? I know my older kids, the oldest, just learned a little bit about eating disorders, came home thinking that it's just, you know, thin, white, affluent, teenage, you know, like that same like Karen Carpenter presentation, that's what anorexia is. And that's the only eating disorder. And I'm like, that's not true. But not everybody has a parent at home who's an eating disorder specialist. So, yeah.
Right. It's maddening, the BMI thing. I think, first of all, I could be wrong. I'm definitely not the expert in this area, but I think BMI is a bullshit measure.
Really bullshit.
But very good tips. Very, very good tips. It can feel overwhelming. So if you're feeling overwhelmed listening, family, just take a deep breath. The fact that you're listening to this podcast already shows that you're mindfully seeking out the right information. So allow yourself time to breathe. And when you're ready, you can act on it. These are really helpful tips. And so as people are going through the holiday season, there's more parties, there's all the stuff. And I know we're just about out of time. But what tips or strategies come to mind for helping people navigate this time of year where there is going to be probably more psychosocial distress, particularly as people get older? Like a kid goes and doesn't eat the pizza, and it's not that big of a deal. It's a kid. Kids do that sometimes. You go to a holiday party and you're like, I can't touch any of that, or there's some different psychosocial distress. That has a different impact. And so what would some tips be that you could share?
Number one, boundaries. Like setting the boundaries for yourself and then also around. I know some families currently with everything happening, you know, we're not talking about politics, things like that, like just setting those boundaries. Or even not going, if you are genderqueer, trans, or whatever, and in your family still deadbeings you, you don't have to go. You don't. You can say no. Because those are the kind of things that will probably like really trigger the eating disorder even more. And just, you know, finding your family, the people that you want to spend the holidays with. So like being able to just say no and don't say yes out of pressure or whatever. You don't have to do that. Those are like special considerations. So like really setting boundaries. And then when you are going, like, you know, are you, depending on the eating disorder struggle, how things are doing, just having that awareness, journaling.
Yeah.
Just, you know, things that you might do in third grade. And I know you asked earlier about like therapeutic techniques. So with eating disorders, it's like, I use a lot of the unified treatment. And then also there's cognitive behavioral therapy, the enhanced burden for eating disorders, as well as like DBT. So a lot of like DBT skills can be really, really helpful this time of year for people, like just distraction or self-soothing, just things so they can actually access like doing the meal and being able to just dismiss diet culture, laughing at it. Like if you have a family member, we can't control what comes out of other people's mouth. Like you can kind of set the stage a little bit with those boundaries. Like, hey, we're not going to talk about politics. Like we all know, like we're polarized. We're just like whatever. But with some of the diet culture stuff, depending on where you're at in this work, are you the kind of person that is ready to just shut down any type of diet culture? Or do you just have to like deal with it on your own? Do you have people in your phone that you can text? Like, you know, maybe you've been in treatment before and you can just text someone like a friend or something that has also gone through to you. And you're like, oh my God, you won't believe with my aunt so-and-so said, and laugh about it because that's a great way to regulate the nervous system and then not on that eating disorder symptom, that urge that you might have. Practicing urge surfing, so, so important for eating disorders. And then in terms of family and stuff, if you're parents, making the meal accessible for your, again, like a better fed kid, it's better than a starved kid. So if it's like more of that RFID presentation, make sure they have their safe foods available. Even with anorexia, if they're too scared to eat a certain type of food or whatever, are there some of their safer food? It gets into more harm reduction. So they're still eating something. So they're still able to spend the holidays with you. That's what my parents did for me when I was younger. They would let me just bring like a salad, but it helped me. Like it was disordered for, you know, they were enabling the eating disorder. However, it was the thing I needed to be able to access that in that moment. You know, I don't need that anymore. And it was a temporary thing. So if parents are thinking about it from that perspective, that's their method. It's the same thing we do if someone's vegetarian or vegan, we accommodate it. And so trying to just make it an inclusive space for people.
And I think really key to that is, again, just that creating safety piece, because you said eating disorder is functioning out of that intent, striving for safety, right? And accessing is also going to be striving for safety, like a fed person, fed is best. And mm-hmm. So being able to get that access, and then we can work, and it's not going to happen in a day, and we can work towards expanding nutrition, expanding the diet. And I know that it feels like there's a lot of pressure, especially if the nutritionist said they need to have this, this, and this. But you know what? If they don't eat anything, then where are we?
And if they do that thing where they don't eat anything, or it's very clear they're using eating disorder symptoms at the table, don't say anything about it. Don't bring attention to it. It's going to make your loved one feel way more perceived or shamed, things yeah. like that.
Like a spotlight's on them, yeah.
But we don't want to do that. Just, okay, they're struggling. Make a mental note. Maybe you talk to them later when they're more regulated about it. Or like, hey, I saw that you were struggling, because that's going to feel validating. If you kind of pull them aside later, like, hey, I saw you're really struggling with your eating disorder. Do you need to see your therapist this week? Do you want me to, you know, try to schedule an appointment? Figure out what they need in that moment.
Like be off our base almost.
Yeah.
For body-focused repetitive behavior, not being like, stop picking. But yeah, have that plan where you can approach later and you can go, okay, how can I support you? Or maybe your loved one's like, I don't want that, but maybe give me a hug and I know what that means, you know?
Yeah. Sometimes that hug can be so helpful in just regulating your nervous system, and can go back and sit down and maybe eat whatever is being served at the holiday party.
And not the pat down hug where we see if we can count every rib, just the compassion, right?
Definitely no comment on anybody's like weight gain, weight, well, anything about their body. It's just like that's off the table for sure when boundaries and setting those limits. And then also just this is just more general thing. Anytime you have a loved one with an eating disorder, especially if it's your own kid, look at your own. Usually you'll see like, you know, like, did your parents ever put you on the diet or did your doctor or whoever, whatever ever happens? You know, are you dieting now? Like, what is your relationship? What are you modeling for your kids? One of the best things you can do for your kid is to not diet.
Right. And relationship with things like exercise, laxatives, things like, yeah, all of that. Very, very good. Would you be up for, if you're okay sharing the few questions you came up with for kind of thinking about ARFID and screening for ARFID? I know it's not like an official measure, but you had talked about, because if you're okay with it, I'll post it on the blog and people can look at it if you're okay with me posting it.
Yeah. So some of the questions I had on here were, do you regularly eat fewer than 20 different foods? Again, like, you know, a Kit Kat bar and a Snickers bar that count as one fish. So
right. Chocolate candy. Right.
Also looking for, is there the sensitivity, like, do they only like Kraft mac and cheese or like, can they do these other ones?
Right. Is it one brand specific chicken nugget or is it, I can eat chicken nuggets anywhere. Yeah.
Also, I think the thing that's really fascinating is that a lot of these kids with ARFID are like super tasters. They experience food a lot differently than people that don't have ARFID. So if you think you're that parent who's going to switch up like, oh, I ran out of Kraft, I'm just going to cook this other like thing that looks like Kraft. They know. They can taste the difference.
Not only do they know, but they also learn, because what they've learned is if you're sneaking it, it's similar to like separation anxiety and I'm just going to sneak out. They learn like, I can't trust that you said this is the thing that I'm going to feel safe eating because it wasn't. And they're going to be even more resistant, even if it's one of their preferred foods. If you're like, no, it's one thing if you're like literally out of food and you're like, I don't have any other option, but don't pretend it's the same thing.
Wait, last night I told my son, I was like, this is the tortellini we have tonight. This is all we have. The grocery store is going to close soon. Let's try this. So being transparent, like this is what we have.
Yeah. Communicating and thinking like just because they're young, you don't need to do that. No, if anything, like developmentally, if they're very young and they're very, very concrete, they're going to remember the time that you didn't follow through and you snuck them something else and you're not going to be able to reason with that. And it is going to be, and there's no shaming because I think people are, I've been that parent. So people feel desperate and it's a very scary place to be when you can't get your kid to eat.
Right. Like working on your nervous system and like how activated you're getting when you see your kid like literally starving themselves.
It right.
doesn't feel good. It's scary. It's terrifying.
Right.
Yeah. And so some of the other questions, do you avoid certain foods because of their texture, taste, smell, or appearance? Have your eating habits or limited food preferences ever led family or friends to express concern or label you as a picky eater? And have you experienced nutritional deficiencies or physical health issues like fatigue or dizziness due to your eating habits? And just some quick little screening questions just to see if like maybe this is ARFID.
Yeah. And depending on age, I know that pediatricians will say you need to introduce something a certain number of times before a person is willing to take it in. And those of us parents that have ARFID kiddos or had ARFID kiddos that were struggling more in the past, there's a distinct difference between, no, I don't really want this and, oh, that looks weird or whatever, to there is a handful of foods that they will eat. If you guys go out to eat, why would you even go out to eat? We're basically packing food for people anyway. If you've walked that road, you know that road. There's a difference between, I just haven't presented it enough times. And I think there is something to presenting it. Like even if we're playing and we're saying, no, thank you, we're getting comfortable being in the same space as it, even if we don't try it. But there's a unique difference than, oh, we're just introducing foods. And there's some major differences there. But it's a good, good question. And I would say that's trickiest probably to differentiate when kids are real, real young or nonverbal, because people end up filling in the blanks. They fill in the differences as they get older. They're like, actually, this is why I don't want it.
And one other thing, if I think for parents with kids with ARFID, is there's a lot of shame for us to unpack. Because if you're comparing out to all the other parents who have probably neurotypical kids, because I really do think that ARFID and like autism and ADHD are probably more linked. We're just kind of waiting on research. you can't hold yourself to this standards, just as like, you know, people with anorexia, like looking at all this fake models or AI generated nonsense, like you can't just compare out to all this other stuff. It's just going to keep you stuck and feeling ashamed. And then you're not going to do what's best for your kid, or in the case of like anorexia, what's best for your life, if you keep getting stuck in that comparison trap. Because that's where I see a lot of parents get stuck, is they're like, okay, or even like if you have a parent, so the grandparent of your kids, and they're like, well, you didn't do that, or they just need to do this, or if we were more firm or whatever it was, it's just like, yeah, these kids are different.
Or you did it, but you got over it. So you just need to stick with it. And it's like, stick with what? Trying to shove things in them that they won't eat. I am sticking with trying to feed them. But that, I am sticking with trying to keep them alive. But yes.
But boundary setting too is like, if you're a parent and you're going to a holiday dinner this season and your own parents are there, you talk to your parents like, no comments about my kid's food. I'm bringing mac and cheese. I've got their safe foods. It's okay. That's my priority.
Yes, it is. It is. And again, that theme of safety. So, well, this has been fantastic, Jenna. And I feel like I could talk all day on this. Thank you for taking a little bit of extra time. I really, really appreciate that you came and had this conversation. I hope, family, for you, that it was also helpful in considering whether it's for a kid, for an adult, spouse, partner, roomie, best friend in your life, or even for yourself, that some of these tips could be helpful. And you don't have to have an eating disorder to be impacted by dieting culture or augmented reality. And so if anything, I hope that you can walk away going, hey, actually, I'm not alone. And there are options out there and tools out there that can help. And so hopefully we struck that tone with the hope. And I just thank you again, Jenna, for coming.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Intrusive thoughts. Family, how helpful was this conversation? Jenna, you were so gracious to join us for this talk at such a busy time of year. But thanks again for sharing your wisdom our way. OCD and ED don't slow down because it's holiday time. And I just know these tips and resources will help so many people. And that brings us to my intrusive thoughts segment, which for any new family joining us is my application segment of the show. And for today's segment, I'm going to challenge us all to circle back to that idea of staying present. In the hubbub of the holiday season, it's very easy to get swept away in our to-dos, different emotions, and the like. And when it comes to both OCD and ED,
same fam, same.
Have you ever sat around looking at social media, feeling anxious because so-and-so has their shopping done early or has a pristine kitchen when yours might look like an endless overflow of dirty dishes and you haven't bought a thing? Do you like chatting with filters on because it enhances what you project to the world? What would it feel like if you didn't use the filter? Has your neighbor or your cousin finished with all their wrapping and it's perfect as always? Or maybe your partner is already diving into their fitspiration while you're feeling anxious and busy brushing crumbs off your shirt. Family, there's no shame in being who we are or acknowledging the complex emotions and challenges this time of year brings. But comparison and filling in the blank with inferences, particularly for those of us that can jump to those confused conclusions, it's hard. So my challenge for you is to think about one way that you can practice being more present today. If the social media is sucking you in or making you feel all the things, then what if you took a social media break? Whether for an hour or part of a day, what if you intentionally put down the augmented world of comparisons and focused on something that recharges you, like a bubble bath or a cheesy holiday movie? For some, it might be shutting off the news or maybe our phones altogether. Maybe just putting ourselves in airplane mode for a hot minute to unplug. If you're busy running around, maybe it means stopping to ask, hey, have I had anything to drink today? Have I fueled my body lately? What do I need in this moment? If I'm tired, can I rest? Maybe even go to bed? Because family, again, listening to ourselves, creating space that supports not only recharging, but safety for ourselves or others, that is key, not only to our daily work, but in the case of these mental health disorders discussed too. So if you're a parent and your loved one is struggling with ED and OCD and your nervous system is fried, what can you do to practice some self-compassion and foster regulation for you? Because you're the only you there is, and I'm the only me. And when we take care of ourselves, then we have the bandwidth and the ability to create amazing supports, both for ourselves and for others. And the truth of the matter is, as I always say, we're better together. So invest in you, here, now, in the present. Because in the end, it may just be the best present you receive. Thank you for joining me and our OCD family community. If you enjoyed what you heard today, please like and subscribe to the OCD Family Podcast wherever you enjoy your podcasts. Did you find this content helpful? Please consider leaving a review. The more people that know they're not alone, the better. For more information regarding today's podcast, please visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com and remember to join the email list while you're there. It will provide you with the most up-to-date information, resources, and the down low on the family chatter. Oh yeah, nothing says family like Jenna Stone and me taking on ED and OCD. That's right, I went there. And you can too at OCDFamilyPodcast.com.
Therapists, are your clients struggling with disgust-based contamination OCD? Have you tried upgrading your ERP with the Mastery approach? Visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses and click on my link because I've got just the training for you. At OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses, you can check out OCD Training School's entire catalog of courses, including Rich Gallagher's course, Treating Contamination OCD. Where else can you build mastery over disgust-based triggers while supporting the fam at no extra cost to you? It's a win-win at OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses.